You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Joining us today is Andrew Roberts. Andrew Roberts is the New York Times bestselling author of The Storm of War, Masters and Commanders, Napoleon and Wellington and Waterloo. A popular political commentator and presenter of history documentaries, he is a prize-winning military historian, an avid collector of Napoleonic, and he has visited all but six of Napoleon's battle sites and dozens of archives in America, Europe, and Russia to research his book. He lives in New York City, and this is a huge book. It's an awesome book from what I've read so far, and we're going to talk to Andrew about that book. Andrew, thank you very much for being with us here today.
It's a great honor. Thanks very much for having me on, Louis.
Now, you have researched Napoleon for a long time. You've been to these battle sites. You've collected a lot of stuff. What led you to write, as some people might say, one more book on Napoleon?
Well, you're quite right. There are vast numbers. There are as many books with Napoleon in the title as there have been days since his death. So it's a perfectly reasonable question that you ask, why on earth do we need another? The fact is that I've been very fortunate because this is the first single volume life in English to be written since the publication of his 33,000 letters by the Fondation Napoleon in Paris, a great scholarly institute. And I've been very fortunate with my timing, really, to bring out my book now.
As far as the letters, and 33,000, that is a lot of letters. Were they letters like all kinds of letters, love letters, letters to some of his colleagues, to other people?
Absolutely every single letter that he ever put his name to. So, yes, some very erotic love letters to Josephine and his second wife. Also, many letters to his marshals, to his generals, his diplomats, his ministers, his friends, and an awful lot to his family. He was a very close family man, and so he had this extraordinary capacity to write 15 letters a day. He had secretaries staying up all night, round the clock, to take his dictation.
We're visiting with Andrew Roberts. Andrew is the award-winning author and the author of Napoleon, A Life, and it's a Viking Press. It's a big book, and as Andrew mentioned, he had the opportunity to look at the 33,000 surviving letters, which radically transform our understanding of Napoleon's character and basically his motivation. You mentioned that he was an extreme family man, caring, and a lot of people, you know, can't see that side of Napoleon because they see him as the general, the conqueror, the leader. But one of the things that I found, and it was surprising to me, is that he was a very forgiving man.
Yes, that's right. He was betrayed on a regular basis, certainly by his chief of police, Joseph Fouché, and also by his foreign minister, Talleyrand. And again and again, he let them off. And this really does underline the fact that he was not a kind of Hitlerian dictator, one of those totalitarian dictators who would have shot both of those people out of hand.
Why did historians compare him to Hitler?
Well, I think, of course, he was a dictator, though not a totalitarian one, I would argue. And he also tried to invade Britain and ultimately came to grief because of his invasion of Russia. So those things make people mistake Napoleon for Hitler. But what they don't see is the positive side, the creative side, the builder, the person who was interested in creating the French education system or the legal system with the Code Napoleon. Various other very positive aspects of Napoleon which have got nothing in common with Adolf Hitler whatsoever.
We're visiting with Andrew Roberts. He is a New York Times bestseller of various books, and he is an award-winning historian, and his latest book is Napoleon, A Life. As you were discussing him being a family man and, you know, forgiving those who betrayed him, he also, and this is another side that we don't see much of Napoleon or hear about, is the human side, the personal side, the fact that he married twice for love and twice he was betrayed.
Yes, that's right. Yes, both his wives were unfaithful to him. Josephine, within only a few weeks of their marriage, they only had 2 days of honeymoon before Napoleon had to go off to the Italian campaign. But Josephine then fell in love with a cavalry hussar, and Napoleon didn't find out about this for another 2 years when he was in the desert outside Cairo, and that was the point at which he started this long series of affairs with no fewer than 22 mistresses.
He ended up forgiving Josephine, did he not?
Yes, he did, and actually they, for many years, had a close and loving relationship, but she couldn't have children, and he desperately needed a son to carry on his dynasty. And so, very sadly for him, he didn't want to do it. He divorced her and married the daughter of the Emperor of Austria, and she gave him a son, the King of Rome. And then she was unfaithful to him as well.
We're visiting with Andrew Roberts. Andrew is the author of Napoleon, A Life. Andrew, one of the things that surprises me, and well, it surprises all of us, I guess, who read your book or started to read your book, the fact that you had access to these letters and to these archives. And one of those things that you discovered was an assassination attempt against Napoleon.
Yes, that's right. Well, what I've actually discovered, people knew about the assassination attempt, and because not least because 12 people were guillotined for it, but I discovered the link between the would-be assassins and the British government. In fact, it turns out that the British government of the day was behind this assassination, knew all about it, financed it, and made it and gave it the logistics necessary for it to take place. It failed. But nonetheless, it was a government-sanctioned operation.
You had the opportunity, as you mentioned at the beginning, to have access to these letters and archives that other historians may have not had. And one of the things that may have helped you, and it helps us all when we read this, because whether it be Abraham Lincoln, whether it be Napoleon, George Washington, any historical figure, there are always myths and stereotypes about them. And this book debunks a lot of those.
Yes, well, the first one it debunks is this idea that he was a small, physically small man. The fact is that he was 5'6", same height as Winston Churchill, who nobody thinks of as being particularly small. But as a result of the caricatures that were drawn of him by some of the great British caricaturists of the early 19th century, men like Thomas Rowlandson and James Gilray and George Cruikshank, always depict him as a midget. And so people still have this idea of him being small. In fact, he was exactly the same height as the average Frenchman of his day.
Why is it that they did that, Andrew?
Oh, in order to try to minimize his political stature. By making him look small compared to everybody else in the caricatures, they were trying to make him seem small. It's an old trick that used by these caricaturists, but we really shouldn't, 200 years later, still be under the misapprehension.
A lot of the pictures we've seen of Napoleon, and one that really stands out, and I guess everybody remembers this one, is of him with his hand inside his coat pocket or inside his coat. And comedians have talked about the fact that Napoleon was not a politician because he had his hand in his own pocket.
Yes, or he had his hand on his wallet. I've also heard theories that he stood like that because he was scratching his scabies. He did have scabies, but that wasn't the reason that he put his hand in his pocket. No, he was attempting to look like the old Roman emperors who would put their hands inside their togas when they were being sculpted. That was the reason for it.
We're visiting with award-winning author and New York Times bestseller, Andrew Roberts, author of Napoleon, A Life. Andrew, you have some beautiful pictures in this book. Tell me about having access to these pictures, and how did you decide which ones to choose?
Well, yes, thank you very much for mentioning that, because very often when people talk about books, they just talk about the words in them rather than the gorgeous illustrations that have taken an enormous amount of time to bring together. And Yes, some of them are from the Bodleian Library in Oxford, where I did a lot of research, and others are really taken from all over the world, including Russia and Austria. And what I tried to do very much was to have pictures that other people haven't seen of Napoleon, not the old obvious ones that are always trotted out in every biography of Napoleon, but some sort of slightly unusual ones. And the other thing I'm very proud of is that we've got 32 maps of France and Europe and battlefields and the rest. I think maps are tremendously important for a man who obviously did get around as much of the world as Napoleon did.
We're visiting with Andrew Roberts. Andrew is the author of Napoleon, A Life, and it's a big book, and it's got a lot of illustrations, maps, as Andrew mentioned. And Andrew has had the opportunity to access as many as 33,000 surviving letters and documents and other archives. At the beginning of the interview, we mentioned that you are a collector of Napoleon era artifacts, etc. Tell us how you started doing this and what you have and how difficult has it been to acquire these?
Well, I've been doing it really for years. It's not absolutely central to my history writing. It's more of a hobby, needless to say. But yes, I go to auctions and buy bits and pieces. The other day I got a piece of the wallpaper from the room in which he died, which is a rather beautiful, beautiful thing. I've got various invitations to the funerals of Nelson, Wellington, and various other people involved in that, and letters from various of Napoleon's marshals. I'm not an obsessive like some people I've come across in the course of 7 years in which I've been writing this book. But it is nice to have a few things around. I had a lock of Napoleon's hair on my desk when I was writing the book, although that was lent to me by a friend.
Was your hand in your pocket?
It's had to come out of my pocket with wadges of dollars to get some of these things, especially the medals. They're very expensive, but utterly beautiful things. And I don't know. I've got a bust of Napoleon that's looking down on the keypad of my word processor as well. It's very easy. Once one starts this kind of thing, and I think I started about the age of 10, then it does sort of snowball slightly.
We're visiting with Andrew Roberts. Andrew is the author of the book Napoleon, A Life. It's put out by Viking Press. Andrew, a lot of people, as we mentioned, have either stereotypes or misconceptions of Napoleon. And some people would ask, was he a revolutionary reformer? Was he a lawmaker? Was he a visionary builder of the first modern state? Or was he a paranoid, egomaniacal dictator who sacrificed millions of lives for his own advancement?
Certainly wasn't the second of those. The fact is that, yes, he declared an opportunistic war in Spain, and he also, of course, disastrously went to war with Russia in 1812. But the other seven wars of the coalitions were declared against him. And so he can't be accused of being a maniac or a bloodstained tyrant, because many more wars were declared against him than he declared against others. Neither is it true to say that that he had a Napoleon complex. Napoleon didn't have a Napoleon complex. The decision to go to war in Russia was actually, when you look at the letters, much more rational, much more logical. He had no idea of trying to go all the way to Moscow. He just wanted to fight on the borders of Russia. He had an army twice as big as the Russians, and he'd beaten them twice before. So it's not evidence of some kind of maniac power obsession.
Tell us a little bit about, you mentioned wars, and so we're going to talk about the American Revolution, George Washington, the general, and Napoleon, his own general. And there have been comparisons between both men. And you mentioned a little bit of that in your book. You want to tell us about that?
Oh, yes. Well, Napoleon admired George Washington very much. He declared 10 days of mourning when George Washington died. He had to be more than George Washington, though. You know, although, of course, he was a general and a soldier statesman in the way that Washington was, he also had to be financier. like Hamilton, and a constitution writer like Madison, and a diplomat like Monroe, and a wordsmith like Jefferson. He was, in a sense, had to be, all of your founding fathers put together, because he found a failed state in 1799, and only 6 years later he left it the most powerful state in Europe.
As you mentioned, some of our founding fathers, one of them, of course, Thomas Jefferson, and everybody knows about that deal that he and Napoleon made, and that's the Louisiana Purchase. Tell us about this.
What a wonderful deal it was. I mean, it's got to be the deal of the century, really, this amazing land deal where a vast amount of land, which now covers 13 states of the modern USA, going all the way up to the Canadian border, so it wasn't just Louisiana by any means, was bought for 2 cents an acre by the Jefferson administration. And it also worked very well for Napoleon. It's one of those rare moments in history where both sides actually do a very good deal for both of them, because Napoleon didn't want to go to war against France, and he realized that the westward push of the United States could well end up with that result. So instead, he pocketed 80 million francs given to him by the Americans for this huge amount of territory.
And of course, some critics of Napoleon would say, why did he sell this land to America?
Well, because he didn't want to wind up in a war. You know, the fact is that the United States, the nascent United States, was always going to move westward. And so if France was sitting in its way, then ultimately at some stage there would have been conflict. And Napoleon didn't want that. He wanted to be able to concentrate on his conflicts in Europe and his fight against Britain in particular.
We're visiting with Andrew Roberts. Andrew is the author of the book Napoleon, A Life. It's put out by Viking Press. Andrew, we all have mentors. We all have people we look up to, or perhaps ask for help. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that two of your mentors are Max Hastings, who of course has written a lot of books about World War I, and Paul Johnson.
Yes, both of them are very impressive historians, very nice people, very highly intelligent men. But unfortunately, in this case, both of them hate Napoleon. In Max Hastings' review in the Wall Street Journal of my book, he was very nice about my writing, but he made it perfectly clear that he sticks to this British historian's view, especially British historians whose mindset was created by the Second World War, who see everything through the prism, through the lens of the Second World War, and so equate Napoleon with Hitler. So Max and Paul, who, although they're friends and very good writers, I think they've just got it completely wrong politically on this.
We're visiting with Andrew Roberts. He is the author of the book Napoleon, A Life, and put out by Viking Press. And we're continuing to talk about Napoleon, the book, and also Napoleon, the man. And one of the things that it's interesting that people might wonder about Napoleon as a general, as a leader, what advice would he give, let's say, President Obama today?
Well, I'm not sure he'd have that much useful advice to give with regard to Iraq and Afghanistan, because, of course, it was in Spain and Russia that Napoleon came to grief. In fact, the very term guerrilla was coined in the Iberian campaign of the Spanish non-regular forces fighting against his armies. So, in that sense, I don't think he'd be much help. However, in terms of his leadership style, I mean, he was one of the great leaders of history, and I think that there are lots of techniques and secrets of leadership that really do pass beyond the confines of his own time and are fairly timeless. The ability to give great speeches, the ability to choose the right people for the right jobs, the ability to think strategically, think ahead, the ability to encourage and advise and warn. These are all things to be found in his correspondence in my book, and which I think are pretty timeless leadership lessons for any generation.
we're in an era of political correctness, and a lot of things that we used to say or our forefathers used to say cannot be said anymore, or you have to take it in the context of time. So my next question is, there have been rumors, talks about Napoleon being a sexist. How was his treatment of women? We understand about Josephine and his other wife and how forgiving and loving he was. But what about Napoleon in general with women?
Yes, he, as the modern parlance would be, he had a woman problem. He didn't give power to women in the Code Napoleon. He didn't give power, political power, to women. He thought that the big problem of the Bourbons was that the mistresses of Louis XVI, Louis XVIII, and Louis XIV were very bad news for France. So he made sure that the women had no political input while he was emperor. But one, as you say, has to see this in the context of the time. I mean, the French didn't give the vote to women until the year 1946. So one has to, I think, contextualize this side of him.
We're visiting with Andrew Roberts. Andrew is the author of Napoleon, A Life. It's put out by Viking Press. You mentioned earlier about General Washington and fighting the American Revolution, and then, of course, General Napoleon Bonaparte, and the fact that people might wonder, why is it that the two revolutions went in completely different directions?
Well, that's right. Of course, General Washington gave up the presidency when his term ended, and like Cincinnatus, he returned to the plow, which is exactly the opposite of what Napoleon did, who made himself emperor and kept on to power. And the reason is that after the Battle of Yorktown in 1781, America wasn't under danger of invasion for another 30 years, really, until the War of 1812. Whereas in the 30 years after the French Revolution, Napoleon had to fight off seven coalitions, and there were endless attempted invasions of France, and the last two of them were successful. And so I think it's unfair to see the American and the French Revolutions as being analogous. They weren't, because of the foreign policy problems.
We're speaking with Andrew Roberts. Andrew is the author of the book Napoleon, A Life. Andrew Roberts is New York Times best-selling author. He has additional books that he's worked on, but Napoleon is the latest book, and it's, again, it's Napoleon, A Life, put out by Viking Press, and it has some beautiful pictures, as we talked about before, and including some maps. And one of the pictures, and I guess it's a drawing that captured my attention, Andrew, is that one of Napoleon on his deathbed.
Yes, it was drawn by Captain Frederick Marryat, who was a Royal Naval captain who went to see the body as it sort of lay in state, as it were, before it was buried. And it is a rather powerful image, isn't it?
It sure is, and it's incredible to see all the power that this gentleman had, and then you see him there almost helpless and realizing that, you know, we're all going to face death at one point or another.
Of course, and he faced it at the age of 51, which is actually the same age as I am at the moment, so it does rather concentrate the mind. His father died of cancer when he was 35, and Napoleon was only 15. He had to really bring up the family together with his elder brother, but really much more him than anyone else. And he landed as a penniless refugee in France in 1793 and was the leader of the country only 6 years later. It's an extraordinary story, adventure story, really, one that Sir Winston Churchill said that Napoleon was the greatest man of action since Julius Caesar. And I very much got that sense when I was writing this book.
We are running out of time. We have about a minute left. But, Andrew, if there's anything else that perhaps you'd like to tell us about your book or something that we didn't cover. Andrew Roberts is, of course, the author of the book Napoleon, A Life. Andrew?
Well, Yes, I'd like to say that he had a great sense of humour. There are about 60 or 70 Napoleon gags in this book. You don't think of dictators as having as being funny, but Napoleon was a tremendously funny man, which is another aspect of his personality that that came as a bit of a surprise to me, and I hope it will to readers as well.
We want to thank you very much for joining us. We have been visiting with Andrew Roberts, author of Napoleon, A Life.
This is Primetime Postscript. I'm Mike Cuthbert. Portland, Maine is home to the last standing maritime signal tower in the United States. Before two-way radio and the telegraph were invented, signal towers were built to aid communication between ship and shore. Hundreds of towers lined the coasts. The Portland Observatory, built in 1807, stopped signaling in 1923, but remains as a museum and a place to learn about a forgotten piece of naval history. Jessica Lockhart reports.
The Portland Observatory is not a lighthouse. Yet, at 86 feet high, this octagonal wooden tower, built on Portland's Munjoy Hill, gets mistaken for a lighthouse all the time. Visitors who come to take a tour will instead find out about the deep history of commercial maritime shipping and the golden age of sail. Docent Jeannie Bull has volunteered at the observatory for 8 years. She begins each guided tour by talking about the purpose of the signal tower. It was a business venture where vessel owners paid to have their flags displayed atop the tower.
Captain Moody, Lemuel Moody, who built this property, this was a ship-to-shore communication device. So the flags would be indicating what type of activity was going on in the harbor. And he had certain flags. He had paying clients. That was how it worked as a business. So if he saw one of his clients' ships coming into the approach of the harbor, he would raise that flag so everyone on the peninsula could see that that ship was on its way in.
And when workers saw the flags, they headed down to the wharfs to arrive ahead of the ship, ready for hire.
Unless you were one of his paying clients, he would not identify the vessel. So it behooved ship owners to pay him. It was $5 a year, which in 1807 was a significant amount of money.
Lemuel Moody was a sea captain turned entrepreneur who had his hand in every aspect of the construction of the tower.
So we are offering tours. They're about half an hour long. You have to go up. That's the point, though, right?
The observatory is maintained by Greater Portland Landmarks, a nonprofit organization. Jennifer Pollack is the manager of education programs.
In the last two seasons, we've had just over 10,000 people. We have loads of visitors, somebody from almost every single state, and about 35 to 45 countries each year are represented.
People have come from Fairview, New Jersey, Warsaw, New York, Fargo, North Dakota, Moorhead, Minnesota, San Diego, California. Yesterday we had some folks from Oslo, Norway, from Texas, Tallahassee, Florida.
Most port cities had observatories or signal towers of some kind. I believe Baltimore had 5. So the fact that the Portland one is the only one remaining, it's historically significant nationally and internationally. It's also a civil engineering landmark. There's no other building in the country built like it. It's built like a ship. It's ballasted, so it's weighted down to the ground, not anchored to the ground.
Made from white pine, the same wood used for shipbuilding, the observatory is 207 years old. There are 7 flights of stairs to get to the top, and Captain Moody made that trip 3 times a day. He looked through his telescope, set out signal flags, and recorded the weather. And if you're thinking that's a lot of stairs to climb, well, the view on top of the observatory tower made it all worth the effort. For Primetime Postscript, I'm Jessica Lockhart.
This has been Primetime Postscript, made possible by AARP, and today, Jessica Lockhart. To hear more stories and postscripts, please visit aarp.org/radio.
Special thanks to our media partners, AARP, in Washington, D.C.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTB Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer, Norma Martinez. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Luis Sainz.